Welcome back to the program. Thank you for being with us. It is a quite a day. We have a lot to talk about. We have a great group to do it with, so let's get started. And yesterday was an amazing day to watch unfold and to see the verdict and the Derek Chauvin trial. We're going to talk about that predominantly throughout the morning. This morning, we have a wonderful panel to do that with. And, of course, we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. WAMC's Alan Chartok. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm fine, Joe. I just heard Joe say, I just heard Ray say something that was just caught my ear. And that was that the president of the New York State Senate said we're on the verge of ethics reform. There's an appetite for ethics reform, which is pretty interesting because they're going after Andrew Cuomo, which may be appropriate. Nevertheless, if they change the ethics laws, they're going to have to change the ethics laws as they affect them. And that's why we don't have good ethics laws in the New York State Senate or the Assembly, because they don't want to adhere to them. They like it the way it is.
Ethics, schmethics, right?
Exactly.
Well, good morning, Alan. And let's welcome our group here. We are thrilled to have these voices this morning. Albany County District Attorney David Soares is here. Good morning, David. How are you?
Joe, this is my first time on the Wednesday panel. I've noticed a few things. I'm a Friday guy. You got fresh pastries here. You got scented candles. You guys really roll out the red carpet for your Wednesday panel. Yeah. Oh my goodness.
We you got the package. That's good. Yeah. No, we cater to go now. That's good. Well, we're thrilled you could be with us. Thank you very much. We also welcome UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies, Jennifer Burns, to the program. Jennifer, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, everyone. I'm good. Glad to be here.
Delight to have you with us. Immigration attorney and partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hannah, Sienna Freeman Tolbert is our guest. Good morning, Sienna. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. Happy to be here.
Well, happy to have you here. And someone who hasn't been with us for a while, and we're thrilled she's back. We couldn't be more happy. President of the Albany branch of the NAACP, Deborah Brown Johnson. Good morning, Deborah. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well, and thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Wonderful to have you here. I so appreciate you taking the time to do this, all of you taking the time out this morning to talk to us. So let's get to the big story, of course, was that in there was a lot of going back and forth and as to how this verdict was going to play out, and people said, well, it seems like it's open and shut, and yet, oh, we've been down this road before, and we don't know what's going to happen. And yesterday it was announced right around 5 p.m. that Derek Chauvin was found guilty on all three counts, second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. This for the death of George Floyd, whose final breaths last May under the knee of Mr. Chauvin, a former Minneapolis police officer, were captured on video, setting off months of protests against the police abuse of black people. After deliberating for about 10 hours over 2 days following an emotional trial that lasted 3 weeks, the jury found Mr. Chauvin, who is white, guilty of second-degree murder, as I mentioned, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter for the killing of Mr. Floyd, a black man on the street corner last year on Memorial Day. So let's start there and just go around and get everyone's reaction to the verdict, and then we'll go from there. Alan, start with you, and then we'll go to our panel.
Okay, I don't think it's a good idea to start with me. No disrespect meant, Joe, because we have such a distinguished panel who all are in a great position to be able to tell us what they think.
All right.
I do have a question for David Soares, however, which is whether he could distinguish, Joe, between all of those options that the jury had. I mean, can you be guilty of second-degree murder and third-degree murder, and it just shows you what I don't know.
David?
Yes, you can. You can. Each of those counts in that were charged to the jury, and we can delve into them a little bit more, required a certain mens rea. In other words, the top count required the intent, not the intent to cause the death, but the intent to commit the underlying felony, which was the assault or choking in this instance. So the prosecutors had to establish that he had intended to use his knee to assault without permission from Mr. Floyd. They had to demonstrate and prove intent on the second degree. Third degree did not require a showing of intent. It just simply required a showing of depraved indifference. In other words, the Chauvin had no regard for human life, and as he knelt down on Mr. Floyd's throat. And of course, the last count, which was a manslaughter, just required that the people show that the knee to the neck was obviously dangerous, although it wasn't a felony, that negligence caused an unnecessary risk, and that's called culpable negligence. So you can be guilty of all of them. The jury in this instance found that all of those elements were present, and the prosecution did a fantastic job of basically leaning in to the facts and the application of the law. We can get into the jury instructions a little bit later in the conversation, because I think the jury instructions and the hearing that took place late Thursday, was the most pivotal thing, I think, that led to the results that eventually we all shared in yesterday afternoon.
I do want to get into that. Let me go around the group here and get reaction from everyone, though. Deborah, let's begin with you. How did you take the – were you surprised, and how did you take the verdict?
Yes, I think like many Black people, I was surprised. I was hopeful all along. I am looking at the evidence. I believed he was guilty and was hopeful that it would the jury would come back with that decision. But as we know how the experiences, the past experiences in this country, that has not always been the case. So when I heard it, there was a bit of shock. There was a bit of relief and sorrow to think that another Black man had died. But I was pleased that the jury did listen, did see the evidence that was presented before them, and that a white police officer, for a time in my life that I can see, that a white police officer was charged and found accountable for the death of a Black man. And that's something that we have not seen. And so in that regard, justice was served. Accountability was rendered in this case.
Great points. And that idea of justice being served, and when especially, you know, it isn't, it's obviously not just that George Floyd is dead, but it is to at least see the accountability, which you mentioned, which is so important. Sienna, your thoughts?
For me, I always knew that the prosecution was putting forth a very strong case. I believe the turning point for me was when the police chief testified about his conduct. In our experience, when a police officer testifies counter to the defendant police officer, that is always going to be a more successful case. We've had cases before with videos, but for the police to, so to speak, break the blue wall of silence and testify about the conduct and that it was not a reasonable, something a reasonable officer would do, I think for me, that's when I knew that we were leaning towards a guilty verdict. The last case I remember in Texas in 2018, a police officer was convicted of, he was open fire on a Black teen and he got shot. And what happened was his partner testified against him, saying that the partner did not feel like he was in danger, and that led to the conviction. So for me, this trial kind of mirrored the trial in Texas, and so I think the turning point was the police testifying against Derek Chauvin.
Jennifer Burns.
I am a little bit numb, I guess, because although this provides some accountability in this one incident, I'm left thinking, you know, what is it going to mean overall? Is this a one and done, you know, which we've seen sometimes in different cases involving the abuse and the harm of Black people? Or is it really going to lead to reform and reform of the system, not just leaning towards one bad apple? And in this case, I feel that some people are looking at this as, okay, we're going to look at it as individual officers, which is a positive thing. But it's not getting at many of the systemic racist issues that have created the problem and do need to be reformed. So I am pleased with the decision, but I'm also very, you know, cautiously optimistic at this point.
You have to start somewhere, right? And so... I mean, one of the big questions which I want to tackle this morning is this idea of, you know, how things would have been different if that young woman didn't have her phone in video mode when this happened. You know, where would we be and how would things be different, which gets to your point. David, just bring us real quick into where we are now as far as sentencing and when that'll take place. Chauvin was immediately remanded to jail, and sentencing will take place at a later date, and up to 40 years, right? So, but we don't. What goes into that decision?
Well, I have to tell you this: that I think the other shoe, and I agree with my colleagues on the panel here today, who the cautious optimism, because while, you know, I think those of us who are following this pretty closely, we had a sigh of relief. You know, the second shoe that drops here is the sentencing. And in Minnesota, what you have is a bifurcated proceeding, much like in the federal system, where you jury first must determine the guilt or innocence of a person who stands accused. And then after, if there is a finding of guilt, then there is a second proceeding where the people then have to present to the jury some aggravating factors in order to convince the judge to depart from the sentencing guidelines. In other words, here in New York, if a person commits murder, you know, the judge, within the judge's discretion, can sentence that individual 25 years to life or somewhere in that neighborhood, okay? But in Minnesota, there is a checklist because there is a sentencing guideline. So as we stand right here now, the exposure there for what he was convicted of is in fact 40 years, but it does not mean he's going to get 40 years. What it means is that that judge is going to take all of these factors, whether he's had a criminal previous criminal history, all of those factors, and that judge will land on the number. That number, as it looks to me like right now, is going to be about 12 years, okay? So the people now, the same prosecutors now, will have to go before that judge because Chauvin, on Thursday, I believe, waived his right to have that hearing in front of the same jury. And so he's now going to allow the judge to listen to the prosecution and the defense and allow that judge to be able to do the sentencing after the people present the aggravating factors. The aggravating factors that the people will be presenting is the fact that Floyd was handcuffed, after he was handcuffed, he was in a very vulnerable position, and he was treated with particular cruelty. The other thing that they'll have to prove and establish is that Chauvin abused his authority. And more importantly here, I think, at least I think that will make sense to a judge, is that Chauvin committed these crimes in front of a number of children. Mm. And I think that those aggravating factors will influence the judge to depart upwardly from the 12 years that Chauvin is sitting on right now.
We're going to take a break there. We will be back and continue our conversation. We welcome your letters and your thoughts on what we're discussing this morning. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. David Soares, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, Jennifer Burns, Deborah Brown Johnson, all joining Alan and I as we discuss this morning. Again, we welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. We will continue our conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our program this morning. Alan Chartok, along with Deborah Brown Johnson, Jennifer Burns, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, and David Soares, making up the program this morning. We very much welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we'll get into that. Get to those letters in just a moment. David, we were talking when you were speaking just before break about the directions to the jury. Talk a little bit about that and why that was so significant.
Well, you know, so I think what folks missed a little bit last week was the battle that was taking place after all the proof had gone in. And that's usually during the charging decisions. And I thought, and I had a great feeling about the people's case after the judge had ultimately decided what he was going to do in terms of jury instructions, because the use of force instructions were particularly important. Now, in this setting, in Minnesota, with the facts of this case, the people wanted an objective, reasonable standard, meaning if force wasn't necessary, then it wasn't reasonable. That's an objective, reasonable standard. And the language would be any use of force beyond what was necessary was not reasonable. The jury, the instruction to the jury is you must decide whether the officer's action were objectively reasonable based on the totality of facts and circumstances confronting the officer without, and this is very important, without regard to the officer's own state of mind, intention, or motivation. That's what the prosecutors argued aggressively for. So what they wanted was for the jurors to not have to place themselves in the mind of Chauvin, but use an objective, reasonable standard. The defense was arguing that for the language that reads as follows: the reasonableness of a particular use of force must be judged from the perspective of a reasonable officer at the moment he is on the scene, rather than the 2020 vision of hindsight. So the defense was arguing for an instruction that would have allowed for the jury to place themselves in the mind of Mr. Chauvin. And the people won out in the jury instructions. And so I thought that was extremely important. And I think it led to the relative quick time that the jurors had gotten the case and then ultimately made their decision. So I thought that the pivotal thing that occurred last week was the instructions.
Yeah, Sienna, did that surprise you that it only took 10 hours?
Oh, yes. I was very surprised. As a former public defender, that would be, that is usually not a good thing for the defendant. And especially in light of the fact that there was medical testimony for them to go through, jury instructions, as David just mentioned, for them to go through, and that they didn't have any questions for the judge. So I was very shocked at how fast they deliberated that.
Yeah. I know that did seem to be, for many of the analysts that I was watching yesterday, seemed to be the fact that nobody had any questions. There were no questions on that jury. Deborah, when you look at this and you see what had to go through, I guess I'm interested in how you perceive the trial of how it went, and because on one hand you can say, well, you know, this went well, but by the same token, you know, how could it not when you saw the evidence against Derek Chauvin?
Right. I think for us, for me, the important thing was the important thing was the trial, I thought, being a novice and not an attorney. I thought it went well. I was able to follow the information, the presentation of the information, by the attorney, and understanding thinking from a perspective of a juror, that it was information that was clear, the witnesses were clear, that you could put the pieces together, you could connect the dots. Mm. always, but, you know, being an advocate and in civil rights, we're always concerned because history tells us it doesn't always work out the way you think it should. It doesn't always work out even when there are when there is evidence, clear and convincing, that you believe. It doesn't always come out that way. So there's still that apprehension that's there. But looking at this case, we thought it was clear. Thought the evidence was there, and had concerns. I think, as David and others have raised, when you think about who witnessed this, that it was a 17-year-old that took the video, that she had an 11-year-old with her that was witnessing this happening in their community to someone that looks like them, you know, therein lies the concern about what's going to happen and what will be the outcome and the results. So even when it looks good, when it looks clear, when it looks obvious to everyone, the outcome doesn't always play out that way. And that is always the concern. And that's why we still have hope, but reality sets in along that thinking in that continuum.
Jennifer.
What I struggle with is the amount. I mean, it was, to me, very open and closed. I mean, it was a shut case. It was very obvious, right? But, you know, Biden touched on this last night with these exceptional circumstances, having the video, having all the people, all of these things having to come together. Whereas we know in the past, without all of these pieces, people walk. And so I'm concerned about, you know, how things are going to proceed with what it will take in other cases. Will there have to be multiple videos? Will there have to be these things in broad daylight for us to see more convictions when we see excessive force used by police officers? And, you know, I'm also interested in the individual, you know, jurors. Like, what were they thinking? So I'm kind of obsessed right now with wanting interviews with them and, you know, what their thoughts were during this process, and not getting into Chauvin's brain, because I think, you know, that teeters on, is he racist or is he not? And the prosecutors really tried to stay away from making this about race, because we know people tend to not want to convict anybody or charge anyone with being racist. So that's where I'm still, you know, obsessed with this case. And of course, the sentencing, and how, and David could speak to this more, but how will the sentencing and this conviction impact the other three officers when their trial comes up, or will it not at all?
David?
I think that what you're going to be hearing about over the course of the next several weeks, perhaps even during this period of time, because it takes usually about 6 to 8 weeks, as Sienna can attest to, for a pre-sentence investigation report that a judge must order. It'll take about 6 to 8 weeks for that to be done. And I believe that in between that period of time, we're going to see a number of those officers pleading out, because I think they've just witnessed this prosecutorial team and the efficiency that they presented their evidence and the experts that they have. I still can't get over the pulmonologist that was called, Martin J. Tobin, I believe is his name, and just how incredibly clear and relatable he delivered scientific evidence. I think if you ever get that interview with the jurors, as you're curious about their state of mind, I think one of the things that they would tell you, if you could talk to them, was the simplicity of such technical information and how it was delivered, in addition to the fact that I believe the order of witnesses in this case, and putting on that 9-year-old, and putting on the teenagers, and putting on even the young man who called the police, I believe that they set this case up and set a tone for this case that I think if you would just stop this case after the first day, I think some of those jurors may have gone along and voted to convict right then and there because the tone was so well done.
David, I have a question for you.
Go ahead. Yeah, Alan, go ahead. And then we're going to take
David,
a break.
David, I have a fast question for you because, you know, I'm an aficionado of watching Law & Order, and they're always talking about this is a good judge, this is a bad judge. This is a guy who's going to give us a hard time. This is a guy who's going to help us. You're a prosecutor. What did you make of the judge?
I thought this judge was extremely fair. And I'll tell you something else. And of course, Sienna could attest to this as well. But whenever we've had conservative judges in very high level cases and important cases for us in the office. You know, they don't always agree with us, and their rulings we may believe is terrible, but in the long run, we're very thankful for them because it preserves a conviction. It has helped to preserve our convictions. Because if a judge were to allow a lot of information in, and if a judge didn't maintain a good record, then your conviction is not secure because on appeal, trust me, these defense attorneys are going to find something to get that conviction overturned. And then you have the unfortunate task of calling that family and telling them, okay, it's been 5 years, but now we have to go back and try that case. So I thought that the judge in this instance did a fantastic job of maintaining order in the court and not allowing either side to get too far afield from what was necessary and important in the case. And Judge Cahill, I thought, did a fantastic job.
But I was very struck by the calling out of Maxine Waters. I thought that was rather exceptional. That happened outside the court, and he said this would be a potential appeal as a result of that. What did you make of that, David?
So I think he had to take that on because the defense raised it. I think he had to take that on, right? And if you're reading the transcript, what I think you would interpret if you're an appellate court is that he addressed the objection. And I think outside the presence of the jury, he laid in with a little more of his opinion. But during those arguments, I thought that he created a very good record. And I have to tell you, as a person who's been in situations like this and managing an office under, you know, with high profile cases, it is extremely frustrating. And I understand the media has a job to do, but you always want to make sure that you're controlling what is going back with the jury as they deliberate. And you fear that there's going to be outside influences. And I think in this case, the magnitude of this case, having elected officials, be it Democrats or Republicans, weighing in on national television, it just wasn't helpful, and he took note of that.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We have many letters that I want to get to. We welcome yours, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok, Deborah Brown Johnson, Jennifer Burns, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, and David Soares making up our panel this morning. We'll continue our conversation after this short break. I do want to get to the letters, but I also want to make mention, of course, what most of you had probably have heard. But just as this verdict was being reached and announced to the world, an Ohio police officer shot a black teenage girl. And so, you know, that is yet another case to talk about. There's some body cam footage of that has just been released. So we will want to talk about that as well. I do have letters I want to get to. Let's do that, bringing us up to the top of the hour. Gene says, how could the judge allow Chauvin's thoughts about the murder to be considered if Chauvin didn't testify? He pleaded the fifth, so the defense shouldn't have been allowed to say anything about his perspective. Hearsay. David?
not true. You don't have to testify against yourself, but you do have the absolute right to be represented by counsel and to engage in your due process rights. That's one of the most fundamental provisions in our Constitution.
Mark,
and just,
go
just
ahead.
To remind, I was going to say, just remind you, it's the prosecution's job to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. The defense, they don't have to do anything. They could rest right after the prosecution rests their case.
Right.
So it's always the prosecution's job to prove their case. They have the burden of proof.
Mark writes to us and says, I am mindful that justice is done, not when there is a particular outcome, but when that outcome is the result of a fair, open, and orderly process. That has happened in the Derek Chauvin case. That's the real thing worth celebrating here. Jennifer, given your previous comments, how do you respond to that?
I guess it's that idea of individual victories are great, but this is not an isolated incident. It's one that the entire world watched because of the video that was taken by a 17-year-old girl. Because when you look at what the police issued the day after and their I think it was the evaluation they had or their statement of the events, it was really, you know, the suspect was arrested, the ambulance came, took him away, everything was all good. And so what we see is this larger story, and police officers and others who cut away at that story, and they create a narrative that's really false and not true. And so we have a kind of a precedent setting situation, but it's long in coming. And if you look at across the country, just since through, I think it's 2005, or actually we can just look at this year, there's been over 100 police officers involved shootings of people. And that's, you know, troubling. That means George Floyd's situation is one in the bucket just in this year. Since 2005, there have been 7 cops convicted. So that's one in 2,000 incidents. So yes, it's a moment of justice, but it's not real systemic change. It's not real justice for everyone. It's justice when you have all of these exceptional circumstances that come together and are beyond challenging, right? I mean, that's what happened here.
Yeah.
So I understand what the letter writer is saying, that it is a moment. But for me, that moment is very, very small, because tomorrow, as people, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. said it forever, it could be business as usual.
Can I just say something here, because I have to agree with Ms. Burns and her assessment, and take issue with just one thing with that letter, and that is this notion of anything being celebratory, right? Because this shouldn't be celebrated. I mean, this, first of all, the conviction should bring about relief for the family. But we shouldn't read too deeply into this conviction and believe that it is precedent setting. Because when you think about it, today, nothing's changed. As a matter of fact, when there have been previous convictions of police officers in Minnesota, right, it didn't change the behavior of Mr. Chauvin. And I would just like to remind you, I think I've mentioned this before, but I was at a National District Attorney's Conference back in 2017. On the day that I left Minnesota, there was an Australian woman who had been shot. She called the police because of a domestic violence incident that was taking place in her building. And as she came out to greet the police, an officer fired his weapon, killing her from his car. And he was convicted on April 19th of 2019, okay? And days after that, we're talking literally, you know, a year, is it a year later, mm-hmm. that we see this happen to Mr. Floyd? And then Mr. Floyd's case hasn't even been resolved yet, and we see another shooting of a young man, you know, in a neighboring town. So I think if we're looking at what transpired as a result of this decision yesterday as anything positive and having any kind of meaning moving forward, let me assure the public now, it does not. You're not going to have use of force cases that have the police department testifying on behalf of the people. You are not going to have both a telephone and body cam video footages that almost bring you right to the scene in the moment. You're not going to have children and the confluence of all of those, the bouquet of wonderful people that the prosecutor used that term, all present. You're not going to have a fireman driving by and seeing that and thinking that there's something wrong and phoning it in. So this case is very unique. The work now begins. And I would say to you that the work in terms of reforming, you know, policing in America, it isn't about work that takes place from state to state. It has to be done at the federal level. We have to have minimal standards set by the feds. We have to have greater investment so that we're attracting, you know, better qualified. It's called professionalizing the institution, because the steps that I'm seeing right now that states and communities are grappling with, it's, you know, taking protections away. It's slowly dismantling the system, but it's not looking to replace that system with something better and different.
Obviously, I want to explore that a bit more with our panel when we come back from a break. One more letter before we go to a break, and that is from Joel. Unless Chauvin is put into solitary confinement for his own protection, he won't last 12 years in prison. He won't last two. The other inmates will see to that. Anecdotally, that has been said a lot over the last 24 hours. Does anyone want to address that?
You mean there's no racist in prison in Minnesota? I think he'll find like-minded friends.
I would also say that part of the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act is one of the portions of it is to look at what's going on in prisons and how inmates are treated by guards. But I think investigating more into what goes on in the prisons with inmates as well needs to have light shined on it. And of course, we're talking about this to protect this man, but nobody's really talking about that, protect inmates that have been there dealing for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll continue our conversation in our next hour. We have a wonderful panel to do so. Deborah Brown Johnson, Jennifer Burns, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, David Soares joining Alan Chartok and I as we discuss all of this morning. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this break and news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable on this Wednesday morning. Alan Chartok here with a wonderful panel, Deborah Brown Johnson, Jennifer Burns, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, and David Soares. We have many, many letters. I want to get to them and also advance the conversation as well and talk about other issues. I want to get to police reform in a few minutes, and we have some letters on that. First, let's go to Carol, who said, needless to say, I celebrate the outcome of the Chauvin trial. However, my comments have to do with the young lady who documented the incident on her cell phone. I think she should get a public commendation for her bravery in the face of the horror that unfolded. Second, I think she should be inundated with offers of full scholarships to any journalism and or law school in the country. Thanks to her, the trial had the outcome that it did. I do know that the prosecution certainly thank her for not only her testimony, but for her work. Sean says, as a former Massachusetts prosecutor, I thought the questions to the jury pool that permitted them to have seen the video or to have had certain experiences involving racism, but be asked if having those experiences, they could view the evidence objectively and decide based on the evidence and then be seated, was groundbreaking. It was great. Yeah, Sienna, how do you see that? Is it groundbreaking?
To me, that's just, you know, it's normal, right? I think you're referring to voir dire. And to me, that's normal in the beginning of the process, is to make sure that they can be objective. So it wasn't groundbreaking. It was, you know, good questions asked on parts of both parties to make sure that they had an objective jury.
David?
Yeah, that's a voir dire question that I think you're going to, you know, see more and more of in trials, especially when the dynamics are as they were in this instance.
Jennifer, any thoughts on that?
No.
Okay. And Deborah? give everybody a chance.
No, I would only say that if you were a person of color, a black person, the chances are you have experienced racism. And so the question is, can you be objective? And I think they've demonstrated that you can be. To say that you've not experienced, I don't know if someone would be totally truthful in saying that. I can't speak for every person, every black person on this earth, but I think by and large, we've experienced it in some form or fashion in our travels in this life.
Great point. We go to, Lisa, who says the initial police incident report was released after Floyd's murder indicated that he died from a medical condition and died later at the hospital. Who is responsible for that? And isn't that an issue that needs to be addressed? Anyone on that?
I don't think that. I think that a case like this, things tend to move fast initially within the first several hours, and you tend to process things as you would in your standard operating procedure. And then it's only when something comes to light that you then go back and begin to review step by step, and that was done here. And I think that as far as the play by play, the minute by minute, what was so interesting here was the fact that the state's attorneys were able to almost line up the contents of that video. Mm-hmm. And bring the contents of that video and phone calls to life through the people that they were calling to the stand. Because you did have the sergeant that was there responsible for all of the activities going on that testified step by step as to how the complaints were coming in and the steps that he took immediately, and then had all of the subsequent individuals who he had contact with also come on in and provide that testimony. I think it was the off-duty fireman that had reached out and called the police on the police that sent that signal through the department. So I think in all instances like this, you're not going to know exactly what's happening, immediately. But I do believe that there is a process that was followed here once it came to the attention of the administration.
We have a couple of letters on the issue of police reform. Ursula says, why do the police have to shoot to kill? Someone runs away, police shoots to kill. Someone has a knife, police shoot to kill. Why? This doesn't seem to be the policy in other countries. Ursula says, Werner says, I believe the officers should have their hours of service regulated similar to the trucking industry. Officers that work excessive overtime or second jobs can't possibly be able to perform at their best. This leads to mistakes and decisions made in the heat of the moment, often not the best way to deal with situations.
The only thing I would say about that, Joe, is it seems to me that the big issue is who you let become a policeman or woman. Those are that original intake. If you have somebody of caution, if you have somebody with a certain amount of sociology in their background or social work in their background, I think that makes all the difference in the world. That's the only point that I would make in all of this. And I've worked with cops.
Yeah, absolutely, for a long time. Jennifer, talk.
Hi.
Go ahead. Deborah, was that you?
I was just going to say, I think one of the things of concern with us is that for people of color, for black people, it appears that we die more often in situations like this. I mean, when I think about, Dylan Roof, who had a gun, went into Emmanuel AME Church, killed people. And those coming to that situation, those officers knew what had occurred there and that he had a weapon, yet he lived and he was taken to get something to eat. The situation in Atlanta, they know that he had killed someone. He had shot, he had a weapon. He had used it and therefore was willing to use it. And yet he was taken alive, and the statement afterwards was an initial statement. He was having a bad day. Yet Dante Wright, who had scented things hanging in his mirror, his rearview mirror, and maybe outdated tags on his car. Somehow he died. You know, there's something wrong here. There's something wrong here, and that's the thing that we must say. It is not everybody that's being shot and killed. But by and large, when the story is involved us and is ended, that's something that where we are.
David, can you speak to that, especially in regards to police reform overall?
Yeah. I mean, Ms. Johnson's 1,000% correct. I mean, all you have to do is just look at the Kyle Rittenhouse incident that took place on the West Coast, where a young man, not even from that town, arms himself, goes to a protest and begins to shoot people. And this guy's walking towards police with his weapon so visible, and yet he's not confronted with the same kind of lethality that people of color are confronted with. And that is at the essence of what Black Lives Matter really is about, is that you just find more evidence of lethality being used during what should be peaceful confrontations against people of color. And that's the point that's missed by so many who then evoke this Blue Lives Matter. No one is challenging the premise that Blue Lives Matter or that any other kind of lives matter. But the focus of Black Lives Matter is to bring to the forefront the fact that more people of color for very routine confrontations, whether they be traffic or just calls for service, are confronted with such lethality.
Jennifer Burns, how do you look at this when we talk about police reform and ultimately what needs to be done?
Where do I begin? I think one of the things that's lost is that we have lost police as stakeholders in the community, in many places in this country, where, you know, they're there to improve a community through relationships, not just to rule over a community. And so I think part of police reform really has to be an investment in police officers wanting to live in the neighborhoods in which they police, and creating not just relationships, but trust. So community policing can be good, but I think community policing also needs to be supported by social workers and mental health workers, where you have a larger network of people invested in the betterment of the community, as people who reside there, but also as the other residents are their neighbors. So it's an entire city or town improvement. The other thing, I think is that we have to watch what other policies that police are going to have to enforce. Because in the New York Times this morning, they had an article about the pushback of Republican legislatures in the GOP. And in 34 states, the GOP, in just this year, have proposed 81 anti-protest bills. And this means that, of course, if there's a hardening against protesting, that now you're putting police out there in a way where you're causing confrontation between people. And that makes an enemy relationship again between people who are peacefully protesting and the police who are there, who are now in charge of all of these new laws that they have to enforce.
Right.
So I think we have to, the community policing part means that we also need state legislators who are not passing bills like in Oklahoma and Iowa, where they're saying now they're giving immunity to drivers whose vehicles strike protesters. That kind of legislation weaponizes vehicles and allows people to drive them into protests, like we saw in Charlottesville. So, that is also legislators passing bills like that means that you're not really supporting the police or community policing or a relationship between the people in the community and police. You're actually making police officers' jobs harder, and you're punishing protesters for asking for change in the systems.
Sienna, your thoughts.
And I think that's largely a response to Black Lives Matter. I mean, those pieces of legislation that you're seeing surface, and again, in GOP-controlled environments, is largely a response to the misunderstanding of what Black Lives Matter really, truly, truly means. But it also screens for more federal, again, the federal government must establish minimal standards if we're talking about reforms that prevent these state legislators who are putting their political ambitions above the betterment of what's best for society. It prevents them from passing these laws and creating a patchwork of dysfunction.
Sienna?
I agree with what everyone's saying. I think one component of police reform, though, has to be training on implicit bias. I mean, I think that's to be a huge component of it, because as we already have established, it's all very systematic. And it takes very intense training for an officer to approach a situation and peel back their stereotypes about the individual. And that's what we need them to do. So I think implicit bias training is one of the key aspects of police reform that need to happen, in addition to all the other addressing other legal protections that are afforded to police officers when they do have when they do act in violence. Yeah.
Joe, if I could.
Yes, Deborah.
No, if I could just add, I think the other part of that also is removing police officers where you see that they are not, it's not a good match, if I can say it nicely, in terms of their work in that particular field. Everyone can't do everything necessarily, or everyone is not cut out for what the makeup and a need for a particular job. And so if you see that in terms of behavior and actions and that continues, it's not giving them a new assignment in another location. You know, there is behavior that this is not a good match and they need to be removed. I think we talk a lot about the bad apples, but they didn't just happen. They didn't just start on the force. When something happens, it needs to be spoken to. People have to be intentional. You know, that's part of the accountability, I believe. And so when the panelists had indicated earlier that the result of this case, the George Floyd case, is just the start, that's what it is. There are other things that need to happen, as we're saying. There's other things, and we have to be intentional about it. It's not happenstance. It's not happenstance that some of these laws are popping up in localities that David had spoken to. And I think he's saying it in a nice way in terms of the misunderstanding of Black Lives Matter. I think for some people, for some lawmakers, there's concern about what it means and the strength and the understanding of the people that have come out to say no more.
Mm.
And so I think we have to understand what we're up against. If this is a country for all, if we all are to live together, there has to be that respect for one another across the board. One of the issues with Sharman is that it was evident that he had no respect for George Floyd or his life.
You talk.
Those are issues we need to address.
Absolutely.
Sorry.
No, I just want to, you know, you said a moment ago of what we're up against, and I think it gives me absolutely no pleasure to mention the name Tucker Carlson on this radio program, and yet. He is the most watched cable news host on television, and last night his line was that the protest intimidated the jury into a guilty verdict. Right? This is what we're up against too. Alan, I mean, you can speak to this if it's probably unfair, but let's just say the 70 plus million people who voted for Donald Trump believe that.
Yes, the prosecution did such a brilliant job of bringing it all together that it's for want of a better word, BS. You know, we all watched, we all saw the man with his knee on the neck. So for Carlson, who is predictable, if anything, to suggest that, indicates that they're not comfortable anytime justice occurs.
David, your thoughts?
I think the entire network, which they refer to as a news network, and I won't even give them the pleasure of mentioning who they are. They're a farce. They're entertainment. It's malicious entertainment operating under the guise as factual news and broadcasting. And you're right. I consider that. And a lot of what is placed on social media, specifically more of the right wing. And I do believe even with social media and networks like this, it also makes us prey to foreign interference where we see Russians stoking, racism on some of these sites as well. And so, we're at a very vulnerable place right now. And I agree with a lot of my colleagues on this panel today about the need for greater training and the need to actually make better selections about who we choose to trust to enforce the law. That all goes, to the issue of professionalizing the institution. But I think in addition to implicit bias, there's something else that we really need to tackle, and not only in this country, but also in law enforcement, right? And I've been saying this for years. I have conversations with friends and people, and you'll often hear, Italians were not welcomed in this country when we first arrived, and the Irish were not welcomed in this country when we first arrived. And yet, those folks managed to overcome a lot of those issues. And I'm quick to respond. Yeah, but you never had the Court of Appeals, right? First of all, you're never brought over as chattel, treated as property, but never had the Supreme Court of the United States in the landmark case of Dred Scott say that you had no standing because you were actually, you'll never be a citizen. And then followed up by Plessy versus Ferguson and Brown v. Board, which promoted people being separated. So we've only been able to sit at lunch counters for the last 60 years. And when I say that this is the kind of historical references and training that needs to be implemented into the training of law enforcement, it's because we also need to provide law enforcement and equip them with an understanding as to why the African-American community has such a longstanding distrust. When policymakers pass these terrible laws and they put badges on people to enforce those laws. And so the history, our history, with respect to people wearing badges has not been good. But in order to change that, we really have to figure out a way of being able to talk about these issues. And as far as that network is concerned, they will continue to stoke violence and completely back away from it. They will continue to be as divisive as they've been on every subject.
One thing I would like to bring up before our bottom of the hour break is just a story that is that was just released, and that is Merrick Garland and what he announced this morning of an investigation into that the DOJ is going to investigate the Minneapolis Police Department for possible patterns of excessive force. He said, quote, "Today I'm announcing that the Justice Department has opened a civil investigation to determine whether the Minneapolis Police Department engages in a pattern or practice of unconstitutional or unlawful policing," he said in remarks to the Justice Department. He said the investigation is separate from the previously announced federal criminal inquiry into Floyd's death. Alan, how important is that? And maybe even on the back also of what the remarks the president made.
Well, Joe, thank you. It's incredibly important because now you know that the Justice Department is putting its full weight behind the outcome of that trial. In other words, he didn't say it yesterday. He said it today. And I think it's really incredibly important when you consider whether Donald Trump would have done any such thing. You know he wouldn't have. So now we have the law behind rectification of what's been going on all along. It's incredibly important.
Jennifer?
I'm sorry, I missed what Alan said because I got disconnected for a minute.
Just the importance of the Merrick Garland.
I said it's important. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with, obviously, that it's very important. My question about it is this only a response largely due to the conviction that took place? Is this something that will happen nationwide anytime we have incidences of police brutality?
In other words, not to think of it just as a Minneapolis problem, but as a societal United States of America problem.
Yeah, well, it's really responsive.
Alan?
Well, just think of it. If that verdict had gone wrong, and I'm going to say wrong because it would have been wrong, and he had been found not guilty, Chauvin had been found not guilty, this would have had ripple repercussions throughout the entire country. So it's really important now that whatever energy has been produced by this verdict should be followed up on. And I think Biden is doing it, and I think the Attorney General is doing it.
We have to take a break. We are just about up against bottom of the hour break. When we come back, we'll finish up our discussion with our wonderful panel. We do welcome your letters. I'll get to another batch of them in just a moment when we come back. And you've got a couple of minutes to write at them and think about them. Our panel this morning, Alan Chartok, Deborah Brown Johnson, Jennifer Burns, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, and David Soares. And again, we welcome your letters. We ask that you keep them short and to the point and pre-read them so we know what you're saying, and we can actually convey the messages to our panelists. And we thank you for that. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our last call this morning. We have a wonderful panel. We have about 15 minutes left with them. So I'm going to try to get to as many letters as we possibly can get to. And panel, as I read these, if you have anything to say, please just jump right in and we'll do it that way. We go to Jerry. PBS is running Eyes on the Prize, a documentary series about the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s. It was chilling to see the blatant and pervasive racism in the South and to realize it never went away. It just went somewhat dormant for a while. I urge watching the series to remind ourselves how deep-seated racism really is. We then go to Robert. Does the panel believe President Biden took a subdued response to the verdict by focusing on damaging protests? Anyone on that? Going once.
Go ahead. I don't watch all the time. I'm sorry. Sure.
I'm confused by damaging protests.
I don't know. Did he use that term? I wasn't. That did not stick with
yeah.
me.
Yeah. I don't watch television, you know, every moment. And therefore, I really don't know what the letter writer is referring to. But Biden has certainly been making himself clear that the racism in America is, unwanted and unjust. And I think he's been talking about the trial, at least selectively. That's what I watch. And I don't understand the letter.
No, I don't. I don't understand it really either. I do know that the president spoke to the family right after. There were some media reports of him, you know, of them talking to him about that, and it was very heartfelt and I thought seemed quite beautiful. But so I don't know exactly what the letter writer is referring to. All right, let's go back to the letters, and this one from Meg. What if not only police were required to have training regarding implicit bias, but legislators were also required to have some sort of anti-racist bias training? What say you, Deborah?
I think that would be a welcome suggestion, because I think it will help them better speak to the needs and the issues of the individuals in their community. Their role is to represent everyone, whether you voted for them or not. If they won and you're in that community, they're to represent your issues, your concerns, your well-being in that community. And so that's one of the areas where we talk about in the NAACP in terms of civic engagement and empowerment and speaking to our legislators and, you know, challenging them to represent you fairly, properly, and the community, the area as a whole. So I think that's a good idea.
Deborah, you bring up a great point. I mean, you are president of the Albany branch. You represent that branch, but also are a representative of the NAACP. What work do you think is ahead of you that you are focused on, not only in this community, but working with your brothers and sisters across this country?
I think a number of things I had just jotted down listening to this conversation. One of the notes I made is, where do we go from here? Changing perception, you know, how you see me. And it's dependent on who's in the you and who's on the me side of that.
Right.
I think it's changing the understanding about the lives, you know, groups of people have lived in this country. How Black Americans arrived in this country has an effect on how they, you know, we interact today, how people interact with us. You can't erase that. You have to recognize it and deal with the issues with it. And so it is understanding that. I had a conversation yesterday with another group, and I talk about the experiences, the experience I have, and I have had, my son has had, my friends who are Black have had, is different from our counterparts who are white. And there has to be a recognition of that and what that means in terms of how we interact, we talk, we address issues, how we frame issues. And if our representatives, and I'll take it back to that, are going to represent everyone, there has to be an understanding of that and look at how, what there must be in legislation, what there must be in accountability, what there must be in terms of how we create an environment that is just for all.
MJ writes
so
to,
as we go forward.
Go ahead. No, go
I'm
ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, sorry.
No, go ahead.
MJ writes and says, maybe David can speak to this. Would it be appropriate to involve gun control reform as part of a nationwide police reform plan? If part of the reason police are so quick to pull out their guns is because they fear guns are carried by the citizens they approach, would it be reasonable to address both of these as nationwide problems that go hand in hand? David.
Well, I think we need federal action on both issues. Otherwise, we continue to experience from jurisdiction to jurisdiction inequities. I think the federal government, just like the Bill of Rights, just like our federal constitution, which sets the floor for what Americans are entitled to, I think the federal government and Congress needs to work on setting the floor on what is appropriate in terms of qualifications for law enforcement. And then also engage in what it is that people use for hunting and protection, and what it is that's so militarized it shouldn't be in the possession of anyone, like assault weapons. So those are two issues. I don't think they necessarily have to be woven together, but those are two issues that are confronting our federal government and it needs to be addressed.
Probably not in this Supreme Court, right, David? And it is a question of state by state. So when you look at New York State and you see the leadership in both the Assembly and the Senate held by people of color, it's an extraordinary movement. Not so in Louisiana. So I think that that's something we got to remember when we start talking about state legislators.
I want to, I guess, just going back to the letters in our final moments here, Sherry writes, and Jennifer and Deborah, I'd be interested in your response to this. Sherry writes, given how important the bystanders were, particularly the video, I'm worried the police will start threatening and even harming bystanders, particularly if they are Black. Jennifer Burns.
I'd say this is running hand in hand with the arguments in the past that we think that bystanders or even the people that police are pursuing have weapons when they reach for their cell phones. So there definitely is a concern when it comes to that. The next thing that I would say is you're going to find a lot more people who are being stopped by the police, like Dante Wright, who are trying to get their phones going to have some sort of record as a way to protect themselves. So it's a dangerous combination there. And I do think you're going to see some escalation in the violence against the people by the police, not necessarily purposefully, but it involves that kind of distrust and the fast reaction of human nature.
And Deborah?
Yes, I can concur with that. I think there is some concern there. But I think, again, we must be vigilant in that voicing against it, looking at legislation that will prevent any type of action and you know, toward that end. But we see what videotaping can do. And we know at this point in time, that is the evidence that we need. Right. In a number of situations. And so it's not something we can allow to be challenged or disregarded or minimized in any way.
Sienna, your thoughts on that?
I agree with both other panel members that it's necessary that we have to turn on the recorders when we're having these interactions, that we have to, you know, tell someone to stay on the phone and listen to what's happening, because we don't know. You know, the same way that the police officers are saying they have a fear, is the same fear that a lot of people of color have. So I know personally, I've asked people to stay on the phone when I'm pulled over just for a moment. Let me make sure, you know, let me see how this interaction is going to go. And that's unfortunate, because we should be able to have an innate trust of our law enforcement. But it's going to be necessary for the next few years until we see some real reform.
David?
And, you know, I want to...
Go ahead. No, go ahead, Julie.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Jennifer, and then we'll go to David.
You know, I want to touch on what Vice President Kamala Harris last night said, too, is that this is not just a Black America problem,
right?
It's a problem for all Americans. So this is sort of a call to white Americans or non-Black Americans, not Black and brown Americans, to say, if you're not sure, if you see something, start your recorders. Because if you really want to see racial change and racial justice in this country, if you don't want to see people treated this way, if you value each other as human beings, then start recording too. That is an attack on the systemic racism that's underway.
David?
I just want to say that in New York State, with the last several reform measures that were passed, I believe in 2020, and again, it was revisited here when our legislative body took action to 50A. They did also create a civil cause of action, allowing for individuals to sue if their cameras and if they're being infringed upon as a result of them recording any activity. So long as they're not recording in the area where law enforcement is conducting, you know, their interdiction. In New York State now, a citizen can, in fact, sue law enforcement if there's any effort to interfere with the recording.
We just have about a minute left. I just want to thank everybody for being with us and for talking through these very important issues and discussing all of it. Anybody want to make any final thoughts of things that we didn't get to that you would like to address or at least leave on the table?
I can just say that it's panels like this where you have people representing different backgrounds, different institutions, having these difficult conversations. This is how we break through.
I hope that's the
exactly.
case. Yeah. Deborah, I thank you so much for being with us. It's always a pleasure to have you on our program. Deborah Brown Johnson is president of the Albany branch of the NAACP. Jennifer Burns, a regular panelist on this program and UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Sienna Freeman Tolbert is an immigration attorney and partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna. And Sienna, always great to have you aboard. Thank you for taking my call last night and joining us this morning. I appreciate it.
And, thank you.
David, don't think you're off the hook for Friday. You still have to come back and talk to us then.
Just make sure we have leftover tarts.
I promise. Tarts for David. Alan, as always, thank you so much. A really great discussion this morning. Thank you. We will be back with the Congressional Corner right after this.